You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
My Seven Chakras, episode 324.
The seven chakras, swirling vortices of energy, positioned throughout our body from the base of the spine to the crown of the head. For thousands of years, this ancient wisdom has been passed on from master to disciple. What are the functions of these energy centers? And could these chakras help you unlock your destiny and find your true purpose? Welcome to My Seven Chakras. And now, your host, Aditya Jayakumar.
What's up, Action Tribe? AJ here, host and founder of My Seven Chakras, the show where we provide you ancient wisdom, inspiring stories, and action steps that will help you transform your life. So if you're new to our show, then I want to let you know that you are at the right place. Now, before we dive into today's episode, let's read out our most recent five-star iTunes review by a listener called Ronnie711, who writes, "My Seven Chakras has changed my life. I can't begin to express how grateful I am for this podcast. I instantly felt a connection when I stumbled upon it, and it's only grown stronger. AJ, you are truly amazing. I feel like you are speaking directly to me. Your positive energy and your vast chakra knowledge is the perfect combination for anyone looking to find balance. I have learned so much from you and your guests. After our one-on-one call, I knew I was in the right place. Thank you for your passion to help others. I am so excited to start our Chakra Sprint program." Thank you, Ronnie, for writing this review. If you'd like me to feature your review as well, then take a minute or two and share us your thoughts. Go to my7chakras.com/review. That's my7chakras.com/review and write your review and hit submit. All right. So our guest for today is one of the few female Buddhist lamas in the world and is the founder and senior lama of Sukha Siddhi Foundation. She completed the Tibetan Buddhist three-year retreat in the Shangpa and Kagyu lineages under the previous Kalu Rinpoche's guidance in 1985. In 1986, she became one of the first women to be authorized as a lama in the Buddhist tradition. In addition to Kalu Rinpoche, she has studied with many of the great Tibetan masters from all lineages. She has a background in comparative mysticism and psychology, and as a licensed psychotherapist, she's done groundbreaking work in the intersection between spiritual and psychological aspects of our humanity. So if you're listening to this, it means you're really lucky to be a fly on the wall on this conversation. And Action Tribe, please welcome Lama Polden Drolma. So Lama, are you ready to inspire?
Oh, yes, for sure.
Welcome to our show. Really great to have you here. And we usually begin our show with some inspiration. And I know that you featured numerous inspirational quotes in your book, but if there was one that really speaks to you today, what is that quote and how do you apply it in your life?
Oh, there's so many, it's hard to choose. But let me read you this one. Sure. That I'm quoting a rabbi, David Cooper, in my book. At the core of hope is a leap of faith. Not that it will all come out right, but a faith that holds that what we do matters. How it will come to matter, who it will come to inspire, what positive effect it will have is not ours to know.
Wow. And how do you apply this particular, I guess, wisdom in your life these days?
Well, I think the reason that really struck me is in terms of meditation. So we know that meditation really, really helps us when we do it in a myriad of ways. But also that the inner work we do, various kinds of inner work and meditation and other spiritual practices, that it also can have an impact on the collective consciousness of humanity and on humanity, you know, as a whole. So that's why this quote, you know, really stood out for me, you know, that, and of course, on our outer efforts as well, in terms of doing benefit in the world and for other beings, that, you know, we don't know, but if we put our best effort into it, then, you know, we can have some confidence that in some way it's mm-hmm. going to be a benefit.
Got it. So Action Tribe, I hope you're listening. The words that you shared really struck me, which is what you're doing, the actions that you take, it really matters. And it's true, because a lot of time people feel that just because they're doing inward work or going inwards or doing meditation, they feel like they don't have a large impact in the world around them. But the truth is, as we're going to learn today, that we are all energy. And because we're all energy, if we send that intention or that heart energy, like we're going to learn today, towards the other people or collective consciousness, you will make an impact. And that's really, really promising. So Lama, what inspired you to write this amazing book, which is Love on Every Breath?
Oh, I was inspired following our last time we in America that we had a national election, and there was so much more divisiveness among different kinds of ethnic groups, among different kinds of peoples. So the divisiveness, the hatred for people different than ourselves that's been coming out the last few years really strong in the States and other parts of the world, that's what really inspired me to write this book as a way for people to help people to come to a place of loving kindness for themselves and for all other human beings, and realize our equality and our worthiness and our fundamental basic goodness.
Got it. That's a wonderful, wonderful reason to write a book. And it's so beautiful as we come into this age of technology and quick change, fast change. Sometimes this can be difficult to handle. And because of all this divisiveness, we feel that we are separate. But, you know, I've gone through the book and the meditations that you outline, and just the way that you encourage people to think allows them to remember that we are, in fact, part of a collective. Now, I'm curious, how did your spiritual journey begin? Could you take us back to maybe your childhood?
Yes. Actually, I don't usually share this, but this is how it began. I was 3 years old, and I was sitting in the garden with my grandmother at her home. It was quite a large garden, and we were sitting there, and I remember it was sunny. It was the summer. I was staying with my grandma for about a week. It was very special for me to get to go visit and stay with my grandparents. And so she and I were sitting in the garden, and we were discussing different things, and we were talking, I remember, about traveling and about that we both wanted to go to China. And I don't know how I knew about these things at three, but anyway, that's what was happening. And all of a sudden, I lost consciousness in an ordinary sense. I didn't lose consciousness inwardly, but I lost consciousness of the outer world. And all of a sudden, it was clear blue sky was all I could see, beautiful clear blue sky, with seven white balls, spheres of light, directly each above the other. So a ball of light, a ball of light, a ball, seven of these up above me. and my consciousness went straight up through each of these seven balls, you know, going into the sky in between, and then came out at the top. And it was a very blissful experience of, and also experience of not having form in the usual way of having a body. There was just my consciousness going up through these seven balls of light into just into the vastness of space. And then I just sort of swooned and fell on the ground a little bit. And I remember my grandma saying, "Oh, are you okay? Are you okay?" And I remember thinking, I don't think, even though I dearly love my grandmother and she was awesome, I thought to myself, she won't understand about this. Mm-hmm. And I knew it was like a special spiritual experience. It felt really, really powerful and wonderful. And I've never forgotten it, obviously, my whole life. So that was really the first actual thing that happened to me on my spiritual journey in this life.
Wow, that's a wonderful, wonderful and really fascinating experience. And, you know, as I sort of imagine what you went through, it comes to my mind that you were pretty mature as a child, right? To think about that your grandmother might not be able to. It was sort of like, you know, you from your past life, you know, having that experience. So that's fascinating.
Right. Yes. I think I've been doing spiritual praxis for quite a few lifetimes. I had different memories of that later as a child. And it also, that experience reminds me of the name of your podcast, The Seven Chakras, because I've often wondered, was that symbolic of going up through the seven chakras, my consciousness?
Right. Absolutely. And also I've heard that in certain lineages, you have more than seven chakras, right? So you have certain chakras above the seventh chakra. So I was sort of thinking maybe that as well. So,
oh yeah, possibly. Yeah.
Got it. So Action Tribe, if you're watching, if you're listening, make sure that you know that there's a comment box below, because if you'd like to ask a question, then add a comment and we'll ensure that your question is featured as well. So Lama, how did you come across Buddhism? I mean, where were you and what were you doing?
So I, at a young age, I was introduced to wisdom saints from all around the world. Well, mostly the Orient and then Western civilization when I was nine. And then a little bit older than that, I was introduced to comparative religion and Gandhi when I was 14 and other great beings. So I began studying in all these various spiritual traditions and practicing and learning meditation in my teens, and then got deeply into a daily practice, finally, of yoga and meditation in my early 20s. And then I started praying to meet my teacher. I felt inside like my teachers I'd stay with were wonderful, but they didn't feel like my teacher, quote unquote, like my guru. And so I prayed to meet my teacher. And I actually prayed to Mary, who I had a lot of devotion for, the mother of Jesus. And lo and behold, a Sufi friend dragged me off to meet a Tibetan Lama. And I was there. It was in San Francisco, one full moon evening, many, many, over 40 years ago. And I listened to him for about 5 minutes. And I thought, I just knew in my heart, and that has been unchangeable for all these years, I knew he was my teacher. And so I thought to myself, well, whatever religion he is, that's fine. You know, that's fine. So that's how I got involved in Buddhism. I'd already been doing some Zazen, but, you know, that was really the entry. And then he invited us to come study with him in Darjeeling in his monastery. And I ended up going to India for the first time. And then over the years, spending many, many years, you know, I've been going to India since then over the last 40 years. To study with him and other great masters.
Got it. I mean, it's wonderful that you had this journey where you came across many different teachers. You know, you speak about Christian mysticism or, you know, studying from a Sufi, as well as studying with a, you know, Jewish rabbi. And so on that journey, you had this, you know, deep yearning to find your guru or your or somebody who you can learn from. And then it's wonderful that as soon as you came across Kalu Rinpoche, you know, within 5 minutes, it was like, you know, and it sort of comes to my mind, you know, this quote that when the student is ready, the master will appear, the teacher will appear in many positions. You're craving and yearning and wanting to find that person or that being that will transmit the wisdom that they need to know in this lifetime. So thanks a lot for sharing that with us. And you've written that Kalu Rinpoche has played a significant impact in your life. So firstly, what sort of influence did he play in your life? And talk to us about that first meeting with him. Because there's a very interesting story that you write about in your book where you had mucus flowing through.
It's so funny. You know, I've noticed in different spiritual experiences and when I meet somebody who is a very strong karmic connection, you know, undoubtedly from a past life, that I often funny things happen in my body. Like I might burst into tears for no reason or just like no reason, like sobbing. And, or like when I met him, all of a sudden, you know, I was just sitting there completely normal. I wasn't sick or anything. And all this mucus, like I start coughing, my nose started running, like just a whole bunch, like instantly. And then, you know, I blew my nose and was coughing and then it just passed. It only lasted a few minutes.
Yeah.
But there's often, I find when I do meet somebody I have a strong connection with, there's some physical reaction that my body has, and I don't know why, but it almost felt that evening like a tiny, tiny purification. And it was absolutely wonderful. I mean, he had such an impact on me because, well, him and the other Tibetan great masters that I was fortunate to study with, like you said, from all various lineages, the wisdom was so palpable and so vast and so not about them. I mean, none of these masters, it was none of them were like in their ego in the terms of that was about them, or they were never trying to tell me what to do. They were so incredibly loving and supportive. And they transmitted a freedom, a peace, a sense of, I mean, we wouldn't say it in these terms in Buddhism, but like in a more Christian sense, the sense of divine union, that sense of absolute, vast, open emptiness of shunyata, completely filled with love and awakened wisdom. So just being in the presence of Kala Rinpoche and listening to him and the other teachers I studied with in the Himalayas, you know, and of course around the world, that's really what was so moving for me.
Wow, wonderful, wonderful. So as you were describing it, it felt as if these people, because of their practice and their dedication to self-realization, almost emit a sort of energy that is very attractive to people around them. And it doesn't stem from ego, but it stems from some other source of energy. And that's wonderful. So you're a Lama, right? So what does the term Lama denote? Because a lot of our listeners are from various backgrounds and they're curious.
Yeah. So a Lama is like a priest or a Roshi or a rabbi. Or a swami, but not necessarily celibate, or like an imam or something. So it's basically a priest. And, you know, a lot of lamas teach, not necessarily every single one of them. They may choose to do something else. But oftentimes it's a teaching thing and also functioning like a parish priest or a parish, or a synagogue rabbi or something, or, you know, for a mosque for the imam or something. So it's like that.
Wonderful. Got it. And in your wonderful book, you talk about Tonglen meditation. So help us listeners understand what exactly is this form or this type of meditation.
So Tonglen is a meditation where the suffering that we feel in ourselves and that we pick up from other people or feel from other people is transformed in our heart chakra through awakened presence there that we bring in and anchor in our heart. And the suffering is transformed through the awakened love and then sent out either to our human self or to other being or beings to fill them with love and healing energy from awakened mind. So this is the heart of the Tonglen, and there's, I describe 8 steps in my book. And any of those steps, the whole practice can be done on the meditation cushion, and you can do, you know, a longer or short sit with that. And there's also an on the spot version where once you're familiar with the meditation, any step, anytime, anywhere in life, in 10 to 30 seconds, you can do that meditation wherever you are, any of those steps. So once you're familiar with it, it becomes a very powerful tool in daily life as well as on the cushion. And this particular form of Tonglen is different than people have ever heard of before. This is the first time it's been written down, and it was passed to me. It's a 1,000 years old, this practice, and it was given from an awakened woman who's in my lineage, who's one of the main teachers in the Shampa lineage, and her name was Naguma. Mm-hmm. And she was from Kashmir, actually, and she became fully awakened and was a Buddhist, great Buddhist teacher of her time. And so she gave this practice 1,000 years ago, and it's been passed orally. And I received it from my teacher, Kala Rinpoche, and then again in 3-year retreat, we practiced it. And I became very familiar, and I just love this practice very much. And it's a very special form of Tonglen.
Action Tribe, what if you could reduce your level of stress and increase your energy by just replacing your morning cup of coffee? The name of this coffee is Lion's Mane Mushroom Coffee Mix by Four Sigmatic. And in the morning, I just add some honey, some cream, and some turmeric to my cup of coffee. And it feels really refreshing and relaxing, especially after some journaling or meditation. And in my opinion, it's way better than regular coffee, and it's much more beneficial. Firstly, because the lion's mane mushroom that it contains has been used by monks for thousands of years for increased focus during meditation. It also contains dual extracted chaga mushrooms, which support your daily immune function, as well as rhodiola root, which helps reduce stress. And because this coffee is made from 100% organic Arabica coffee beans, it won't be hard for you to switch because it tastes just like good quality coffee. So if you consider yourself an action taker and you'd like to try out something fun, exciting and new, I'd invite you to place your first order because they've extended a really special offer for Action Tribe. Receive 15% off your 4 Sigmatic purchase. Go to 4sigmatic.com/ActionTribe or use discount code ActionTribe at checkout. That's foursigmatic.com/ActionTribe or use discount code ActionTribe at checkout. foursigmatic.com/ActionTribe or use discount code ActionTribe at checkout.
Wonderful, wonderful. So I'm sure our listeners are right now really fascinated to learn more about this particular type of meditation. And as you said, that it might take anywhere between 45 minutes to even 30 seconds, the shorter format of the meditation, which is amazing because a lot of our listeners live in the cities. And as you would imagine, you know, time is short and they want something that is a shorter format, something that they can apply in their lives as well. But could you give us an overview of the 8 steps in this meditation just to get a better idea of it?
Sure. So again, the 8 steps, it's really good to learn the 8 steps and do the whole thing in as a sitting meditation in the beginning. And always, of course, it's always super beneficial to do that. But if we do that, then it gives the familiarity so we can do any of the steps instantly in 10 seconds or more. So the first step is resting in open awareness. And that is where we just let go of thoughts. And it's basic fundamental meditation as people know it. Let go of thoughts, but you just simply open to what is and let your awareness rest with what is. Mm-hmm. And every time we notice thoughts, we just let them go. And we just really let go and enter into direct contact with what is without concepts about, evaluating it, like, is this good or bad or whatever. We just wholeheartedly open into what is and let the mind rest. And this is like a reset button and always is a really good preparation for creative kinds of meditation like the Tonglen is. So then the next step is seeking refuge in awakened sanctuary. And in the book, I describe how obviously this is a Buddhist practice and it uses all Buddhist terminology and imagery, and but you can also adapt it. My teacher taught this as well for any religion or for people who are non-religious. So in the Buddhist version, in step two, seeking refuge in awakened sanctuary, we call upon all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, our own teachers, all the lineage masters, etc., from all times and all places, and we call them to be with us. And we ask for refuge. And if we were doing this as a Christian, we might call upon, or another religion, you know, the unseen, vast, you know, ever-present God, or, you know, however it is in our tradition, or Jesus, or Muhammad, or Shiva, or Lakshmi, or, you know, whoever. So we can adapt this, but I'll talk in the Buddhist sense, and then people can read the book to find out all how you adapt it. But so we call in all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, etc., our own teachers. And then what this does is they then hold our meditation so that they're transmitting awakened awareness to us while we're doing the meditation. And it also sets up a strong connection for us with awakened presence, which is very hard for us to feel in ourselves, but it's easier for us to open to that in another. Mm-hmm. And they also mirror back to us because they see our awakened self. They see our awakened who we truly are. So they mirror that back to us. So right. That's the second step. We ask them to be with us and transmit to us and to hold us in their love. And then the third step is what's called a Sanskrit term, bodhicitta, generating bodhicitta. And what this means is that we feel that, and that we're entering into our meditation, not just to help ourselves, but to help ourselves and all other sentient beings.
Right.
And not everybody has the inclination or the time or the capacity to meditate. Mm-hmm. So we do it on behalf of all of us.
Right.
And we also do it in order to bring all of us, each and every one of us, out of suffering into everlasting joy and peace, basically into full awakening. So then that's our bodhicitta. It's called... Awakened mind is that which recognizes that we want to bring all beings out of suffering into awakening. So then step four is quite different, I think, than some people are used to, and stepping into love. So this is, and again, I'll use the Buddhist imagery and the Buddhist presence of the Bodhisattva Chenrezig, but it can be adapted. So then in Buddhism, there's a great Bodhisattva, one who is constantly being in our world in samsara in order to benefit beings and help liberate us. And so this being is somewhat androgynous. In India, apparently in the old days, his name in Sanskrit is Avalokiteshvara. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of female male. And then in Chenrezig, when his teachings and he went there, he was called Chenrezig, was male. Then the same being is Kuan Yin in China or Canon in Japan. So, and in China was a woman primarily, but with some masculine characteristics. And also when Avalokiteshvara Chenrezig appeared as a woman, there were some masculine. So it's a very androgynous bodhisattva being. Anyway, we call upon the Bodhisattva of compassion, or it could be Jesus or someone else. And we imagine that this being, this great awakened being who's constantly full of love and compassion, is above our heads. And we pray to this awakened being that our own love and compassion, which is infinite, but it's in our hearts, and we're not usually in touch with the full scope and magnitude and profound nature of our own love. So we pray that this will be completely opened for us. And then this great Bodhisattva of compassion dissolves into light, into us. He is the essence of all Buddha's love and compassion. So that dissolves into us, and we feel that we're one with awakened compassion. And we feel we're one with Chenrezig Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin. And then in our heart, and I have, since we're on video, a crystal vajra, we imagine in our heart chakra, of course, this is big, a tiny, tiny crystal vajra of light that embodies and is awakened love. It's actually pure awakened presence, which is innate in all of us, is in all of us. But again, we're not usually in touch with that. So then we imagine that all the Buddha's love and compassion, which is, of course, wisdom, love and compassion, and our own innate love and compassion is appearing as this vajra, which symbolizes our pure being, our indestructible pure being that's lifeless and deathless, that's not a thing, that's empty and yet ever-present. So then that's that step, and then we can also chant the mantra Mani Padme Hum, the mantra of compassion, the mantra of Chenrezig, and contemplate our own suffering and the suffering of many beings, and develop compassion for everyone in our hearts, and develop loving kindness for everyone. And then the next step, we start this loving practice with ourselves. So and this is the heart of the Tonglen that we referred to, you and I were speaking about earlier. We imagine our ordinary human self in front of us. And then over here, where we're feeling, we're sitting, is our awakened self with the vajra of light that's super brilliant, this crystal vajra of light, just super brilliant, the awakened mind of love and compassion in our heart. And we breathe in the suffering of our human self. You know, we contemplate all the trials and tribulations we've been through, the challenges we face, maybe traumas we've had, whatever. And we breathe that in as like a dark smoke into the heart chakra. As soon as that touches the vajra emits a lightning bolt, which transforms that suffering into awakened love and healing energy. And then on the out-breath, so on the in-breath, we're breathing in the suffering, and then instantly it's transformed into white light, into pure awakened love and healing, and sent back into our regular self. And we then keep doing that on the breath for as many cycles as we like. And then we see our human self gradually illuminated, filled with light, completely healed, at peace, in joy, and then eventually awakened. And this exchange, this transformation of suffering into love, brings joy. And so then we do like that. That's that step. And usually in the beginning, we recommend people do this practice, this meditation for themselves for a few months, primarily for themselves. Of course, you can also do for others, but primarily for the self, because once our own self-love is really opened and we're able to actually contemplate our suffering and be present with it and then allow it to be transformed, then we have love from the inside out. And our love is more full and complete. Like, we're not leaving ourselves out of it. Otherwise, it's actually an ego issue that we don't want to love ourselves. That's not our awakened mind that doesn't want to love ourselves. That's our ego, because we have all kinds of ego issues about ourselves. So I talk about that and the psychological issues in that chapter and how to work with that some and deal with it and work through it so we can come to really have loving kindness and compassion for ourselves. And then the next step is doing this for others. Mm-hmm. So we start the process with people we love, and we can do it with one or more people, and we include other people that we just are acquaintances, and we eventually work it out to where we even include, and I talk about this and explain how to go about this. We even get to the point where we include people that we really don't like, or we feel like they're really destructive people. Mm-hmm. So there's a way of even including them in our kindness and our love, even though, of course, we don't condone their actions, you know. But like a child who misbehaves, we don't mm-hmm. hate the child who misbehaves. We understand that they're ignorant and they need to be taught and they need to be, you know, learn how to behave properly. So we can even then include people that we really don't care for or who are destructive, and eventually include all beings in our Tonglen meditation. It becomes very powerful, eventually seeing all beings healed, illuminated, and awakened together. And of course, this, even just imagining this, is great joy.
Oh, absolutely. That's so powerful.
Yeah. And so that's the heart of the practice. And then the seventh step is dissolving. And again, after this, we let everything dissolve and come into the heart until there's just simply a drop of brilliant light, our awakened mind, inseparable with all awakened mind everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that brilliant drop of light, then that dissolves into space. And we rest our mind again in open awareness, inseparable with space. And we rest in formlessness. And then the last step is dedicating the benefit, any and all benefit from our meditation. So then at the end, we think, and there's various, you know, traditional prayers for this, but it's also wonderful to make up your own prayer and something like, in whatever way people want to, something like, may any and all benefit from my meditation or from my doing this, you know, Tonglen practice, may it come to relieve all suffering, may it seek to be a cause for the awakening of all sentient beings. And then that's the ending. So it sort of seals the practice, and it offers it to all beings, which expands our meditation's power. When we give it away, when we offer our meditation to all sentient beings, it expands the power and the breadth of it.
Got it. Wonderful. Thanks a lot for sharing. I mean, what I love about this meditation is that it's not just going inwards. There's a lot of visualization that takes place, a lot of creative visualization. And it's step by step. You know exactly what to do at phase of this wondrous journey. It's very visual. I mean, like you've mentioned and you've described to us how we envision our heart as a light vajra, literally a machine of light that is transmuting pain and suffering and the cloudy darkness into an awakened state of energy that not just can be used by us, but also by the world around us. And the wondrous part that you've shared is, and you've alluded to, is that we can't be of service unless we help ourselves. Just like in the plane, we put on the oxygen mask first. And not doing so is, as you mentioned, an ego contraction. Could you talk to us about what this really means? What is ego contraction? And what does this imply?
Yeah, an ego issue. Well, a lot of us, especially in the West, in fact, the Dalai Lama, somebody finally told him about this way back in the late 80s or early 90s, and he was completely blown away. It took him years to grok this. Mm-hmm. That actually in the West, there's a lot of self-hatred. Mm. That there are a lot of people feel like they don't like themselves. And a lot of us have constant or off and on self-talk that's extremely berating, mm-hmm. very negative. Like, oh, you should have done that. And why didn't you do that better? And you really got to do work harder. And you're really not that great. And in fact, you know, you failed miserably at this. And, you know, whatever. It's just berating ourselves, you know, or, oh my gosh, you know, you really lazed around today, didn't get anything done. But it's like a grouchy, condemning voice that we talk to ourselves with a lot of times. And I became aware of this in my own journey because, and I write about this in the book, when I was very young, like 22, and I was did a few therapy sessions. And just one day as I was leaving the room, the therapist said to me, what about self-love? And then I was just, you know, out the door, but it stuck with me and became a koan. And I was like, what is that? I couldn't even imagine what that was. And I started to try to just grok that concept. And I started to see all this negative talk in my mind. And so over the years and talking with many people and in watching myself, I've just come to understand that there are all these psychological issues that we have about ourselves in the West in particular, and of course in other places too. And so this is not helpful. This is like raising a child through condemning them, you know, and it's our ego and, you know, in technical terms, basically usually the superego, but it's the it's an ego part of us that is berating us. And we think that's going to make us a better person, but it's kind of like beating the child and thinking they're going to grow up to be a better person. It doesn't really work. People learn through kindness. People learn through being, you know, having things really explained to them, really thoroughly taught from somebody who's extending kindness. So this is something that is important for us to work through. And another correlate with this is that a lot of us don't feel worthy of love. And again, we have to look at this logically. How are we not worthy of love? Is everybody else worthy of love and we're not? Or are only people who are saints worthy of love, or only great sages worthy of love, or only children worthy of love, or are only nice people or good people worthy of love? It's like, you know, that doesn't really hold water when we really look at it. Like, if we look at all the spiritual teachings from all traditions, you know, like in Christianity, they say, you know, each person is a child of God. Or like in Buddhism, it's said like each and every being has the innate awakened potential. And in fact, they are awakened. They just don't recognize it. That then that all of us in our core, like from a pure point of view, from an awakened point of view, we are already innately completely pure and awakened, but we don't really recognize that. So we need to really look at this logically and then work through these issues of self-hatred and that kind of thing. And instead, you know, treat ourselves with kindness and encourage ourselves with kindness. And, you know, I tell people that it's like our awareness that we become much more in touch with in meditation, the unbiased, ever-present, infinite awareness of who we are, or that is the nature of who we are. You know, that awareness is, we need to kind of parent our human self with kindness, with wisdom.
I mean, I think that is a very important point to mention, especially that we have so many distractions and stimuli from outside these days, whether it's the news or whether it's, you know, social media on our phones, which is much more easier to access. But all of these different platforms are reminding us of the standards that we need to get to before we can start loving ourselves, whether it's standards of finances or, you know, our body or even the types of relationships that we have, which is great. It's good to, you know, always have this standard for yourself and to realize where you need to reach. But like you've mentioned, you can't reach there until and unless you've learned to love yourself, because the truth is that you don't need to get anywhere to receive love. You are love, right? So thanks a lot for bringing this to our attention. Now, you write that in this journey of self-realization, we often have an awakened side and a shadow side as well. So what is the shadow side and how do we deal with it?
Good question. So shadow, by implication, by definition in psychology, really refers to what we're generally unconscious of about ourselves.
Okay.
So and good things could be in the shadow as well as negative things. Like, say I'm a gang member and I had to join a gang because at 14 years old, that was the only way to survive in my neighborhood, right?
Right.
So then the basic ego in that sense is to be a bad, tough guy. Mm-hmm. And that what's in the shadow is I'm actually very vulnerable and gentle and loving. There's a part of me like that. So, and then normally a lot of times for most people, and I'm sure for most of your listeners, you know, what the normal ego identity is you're, you know, you feel like you're a good person, you're trying to be a good person, you're trying to incorporate, you know, spirituality in our lives and move forward in a positive way for ourselves and the world. So then what's in the shadow is that part of myself that really is like pissed off about whatever, you know, mm-hmm. or still pissed off at my parents. Or it could be in the shadow that I was deeply shamed and hurt as a child. And I feel this shame deep inside myself. And I can't bear the feeling of this shame. And of course, as a child, we had no resources or people to help us to deal with trauma. So then, mm-hmm. you know, it got kind of buried inside because we couldn't process it, you know, as a child. So then that shame, that trauma, you know, these are, of course, just different examples, gets buried inside and stays in the shadow. Mm-hmm. So the shadow can have all kinds of different elements in it. And it's unconscious, basically. But then, as we all know, it can erupt at times, or we mm-hmm. begin through our meditation or through our psychological inquiry to see these different parts of ourselves and become conscious of them. Or our friends or our loved ones or our coworkers may, you know, let us know about these parts of ourselves, like, hey, that was really mean when you said that to me or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, especially spouses are good at usually, or children at pointing out our faults and failings,
right?
You know, that we may not see, like, kids are amazing like that, like what they see about their parents and, you know.
Yeah, kids are very truthful and honest because they don't know anything else. And, you know, I think as a child, one of the biggest shocks that one can receive is the moment they realize that their parents are not infinite beings, right? They are
and they're not perfect, right?
And I they're mean, not
maybe
perfect.
They
realize
that early on, but maybe a little later. But
So you've suggested that there are sort of three ways in which a person can discover or bring more light into their shadow self. One is through meditation and seeking to understand more about ourselves. The second is through psychological exercises so that we can, you know, dig in and find out more about ourselves. And third is through seeking feedback through people that are close to us, which is maybe our family members, our spouses, or even children because of their honest feedback. So that's wonderful. And thanks a lot for sharing. Now, a while back, you alluded to that there are certain instances where we notice suffering around us. Maybe when we're, you know, waiting in the line at the grocery store, or maybe in some other scenario, maybe when a couple is fighting and we don't know, should we intervene or not, or what do we do about it? And you've suggested that this short version of your meditation can actually help us influence that situation. So how's that? How does that work?
Yeah, so... And this is where that, you know, quote from Rabbi David Cooper comes in. We don't know if it will affect, but, you know, and it doesn't mean we don't do physical action or something in the world or words or whatever. But from the inner level, we can definitely always do something. So say we see that suffering in front of us or we hear about it on the news. So say I hear that there's this horrible war going on in Syria. And I really feel for these people. I mean, you know, nobody likes to have bombs dropping on their house day and night, or, you know, you can't go to the grocery store because you're going to be maybe killed on the way.
Yeah.
So we're feeling the suffering of this. So in an instant, we can just breathe in that suffering, and it's transformed through this Vajra drop of brilliant light, the awakened love in our heart. And then that love, the healing energy goes directly out to all those people in this war zone. And we can also think the people that caused the war or are perpetuating it, they are so ignorant because they think they are going to be happy through causing war. Mm-hmm. And that is so not the case, that, you know, their karma is going to seriously suffer from this. And it's not going to bring them happiness to perpetuate war on other people. So in that way, we can also have compassion even for the people who really, you know, are at fault or started this or perpetuating it or whatever the situation is. And again, we're not condoning or agreeing with their actions. It doesn't mean we're not going to step up and stand up against those kind of actions and behavior.
Yeah.
But we can also have compassion for them because it's profound ignorance to think that you're going to get happiness through killing people, you know, or abusing people or hurting people in any way.
Got it. Got it. I mean, this is a great perspective to have, especially if people are across the world and they seem like they're powerless or helpless in influencing or changing a situation, you know, across the pond or across the ocean. But the truth is, like, even though we might have to take action, and we can take action, but we can also send that intention, that heart energy, that will, in fact, help us make a difference. So thanks a lot for sharing this wonderful idea and action tribe. I hope you're listening and maybe even taking down notes. I know many of our listeners drive while listening to this episode, especially in its audio format. So don't write notes now, but you know, hold it in your mind and realize that you are powerful. So Lama, what is that one action step that you'd like to recommend for our listeners based on all the different things that we've been talking about today?
Oh, gosh. I think a couple of things. To initiate a daily meditation practice if one doesn't have it, and to really know that each and every one of us is innately pure being, is primordial goodness, is wisdom embodied. And we all can discover that within ourselves. So that as we enter the journey, everybody can awaken. Everybody, you know, and whether we fully awaken in this life or not doesn't matter so much. It's like all of us can be on the path, and that the path of spiritual awakening really, really transforms our life into far more than we ever could have imagined it could be.
So, Action Tribe, if you are a visual learner and you'd like to read the corresponding blog post, then visit my7chakras.com/324. my7chakras.com/324. And if you're on your iPhone, don't forget to hit that subscribe button, because it'll ensure that you don't miss on any of our upcoming episodes. And we've got some amazing stuff lined up for you. So hit that subscribe button. Compassion isn't some kind of self-improvement project or ideal that we're trying to live up to. Having compassion starts and ends with having compassion for all those unwanted parts of ourself, all those imperfections that we don't even want to look at. Now, this is a quote by Pema Chodron, and this is a quote actually featured in Lama's book. So this is a powerful statement, Action Tribe. And the more you read it, you realize how true it is. While we may have goals, we may have standards that we'd like to adhere to and maintain and reach to improve ourselves, and compassion is a bit different. Like we're learning today, compassion is pointing the torch of light towards areas of ourselves that we have long forgotten because we are ashamed, we have regret, or we just don't like that aspect of ourselves. Whether it's how we look, what happened to us, or some decision that we have taken in our life that we're not so proud of. Everyone has them, including me. I have them too. And the truth is that those unwanted parts of ourselves that, you know, that we've been ignoring or avoiding are part of us as well. And in recognizing and noticing and healing that part of us, we experience a shift in our subtle body that can really transform our life. So like we're learning today, have compassion for every part of you, even though those parts of you are aspects that you don't quite like or don't want to remember. So, Lama, talk to us about a time in your life when you experienced a difficult situation or a major life challenge. How did you go through it? And then what did you do to sort of overcome it or come out of it?
Gosh, I faced a really difficult challenge in my last year, a three-year retreat. And what happened was in there, we were, of course, in those days, we weren't doing email or any or the web or anything, but we could get letters and that was it. And otherwise, we were shut out from the outside world. But I got a telegram saying, and I was, I think, 32 at the time. And I got a telegram saying that my 27-year-old brother had died suddenly. And so this was a obviously a great tragedy. I had a four-month-old baby and a new wife, et cetera. So, and my family wanted me to come home from retreat. Now, mm-hmm. when you enter three-year retreat, which is actually about 3 years, 3 months, or 3 years, 4 months, usually, or a little longer, it's the understanding that you enter is that you will not leave, that whatever comes up and whatever happens, you will address it and work with it spiritually. And that for this period of time, this, you know, in terms of our whole lifespan, hopefully a short part of our life, that we will completely deal with everything in terms of our spiritual path. So, and, you know, we won't go running outside to the family. If the family's in trouble, we'll do the inner work and the inner spiritual practice on whatever happens. So this is a part of the understanding. So what happened when my family wanted me to come home, and my son was staying with my family while I was in three-year retreat. He was about 12 at the time. And my brother who died had been his closest male role model mm-hmm. and within my own family and, you know, outside of his dad. Anyway, it was extremely tough for me. First, the shock of my brother dying and then the fact that my family wanted me to come. So then my Lama instructor in our retreat, I talked to him about this. And he was going to go down the mountain from where we were because we had no phone, no electricity. And Kala Rinpoche, my guru, was in France at the time. And he said that he would call Rinpoche for me and talk to Rinpoche about this. Mm-hmm. So he did. And he came back and he came into my little hut room in retreat and our retreat Lama. And he said, well, he had talked to Kala Rinpoche. And now I knew that my guru, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that my guru was completely the essence of awakened love and compassion. That I didn't doubt for a sec. But the retreat Lama came in and said, well, I talked to Rinpoche and it was like a cold front coming in. And I said, oh, what did he say? And he said, Paul Dendroma can do whatever she likes, but she agreed to be here for 3 years. Mm. End of conversation. So basically, you know, of course, he was saying I could do whatever I like, but the message was very clear. You agreed to be here and to work with everything from a spiritual point of view and not go running outside to deal with things for this period of being here. So that put me up against the hardest challenge of my entire life, because all of my psychological, my conditioning, but all of my love for my family, mm-hmm. all of that was like super in the forefront, along with the fact that my guru, who I also loved with every fiber of my being, was saying, basically saying to me, you know, you agreed to be here. You need to deal with this internally from a spiritual point of view, not go running outside to try to fix it or to try to be a help outside. So mm-hmm. I actually, it was like standing on the edge of a huge cliff and looking mm-hmm. into the abyss and knowing I had to jump. Mm-hmm. And I knew that in that abyss was my Lama, my Rinpoche, my teacher. And that as I jumped off the cliff, which was the cliff was standing, was all, you know, my psychological conditioning, all my love for my family, everything in me that was screaming, like, I need to be there for my family, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the other side knowing, you know, they will be okay, and jumping into this huge, vast abyss of my guru's mind of awakened love. So I jumped. Actually, my body ended up kind of going into shock a little bit. But I jumped off that cliff metaphorically and processed through everything. And I ended up feeling that the meditation practice I did in those days was very, very powerfully helpful for my brother who died and for my family. And it actually, going through that and taking that decision and facing it and feeling all the repercussions, opened up a much deeper level of realization within me. And the interesting thing was, my parents at that point were divorced, had been divorced for some years. When I came out of three-year retreat about 10 months, 11 months later, they each individually said to me, completely separate from each other, it was good you stayed and finished retreat. And they recognized out of the heat of the moment that it was good that I stayed and finished what I started, and that they made it through that, I made it through, and that in actuality, it wouldn't have helped anything for me to be there. I mean, of course, we would have all felt great being together, and I could have comforted my son, you know, right there on the spot. But in fact, there was all these loving relatives comforting my son, comforting each other, and I was in retreat doing this, you know, incredible, like what felt very powerful meditation on behalf of my brother and family. And, you know, that was best that I had stayed. So that was really the hardest thing I've ever faced in my whole life.
Well, thanks a lot for sharing that story with us. I know this is something that is, you know, very, very hard to go through. And as you explained it, you were at the precipice of the cliff. And what do you do in such a situation, right? And I'm sure many of our listeners are going through this very same situation right now in their lives. In just one sentence, what is that one major life lesson that you'd like to share with our listeners based on your story?
I think overall is that love is the key to everything. Love, engendering love, learning to love is what makes life so much easier and so much more enjoyable.
Got it. So thanks a lot for sharing, Action Tribe. I hope you are listening. I hope you are taking all of this in. And I hope you're having a good time on today's podcast episode so far, where we're talking about meditation, you know, our energy body, and how we can transmute the suffering of others and also learn more about ourselves so that we can awaken. Now, if you're listening to this episode, then it means that you are an action taker. And part of being an action taker is to have this yearning deep down to improve, to change, to grow, to transform your life, right? Physically and mentally and energetically. And with this goal in mind, you take action and you seek help and you get support and you grow along the way. But sometimes you might feel like the growth is happening too slowly. You might ask yourself, I've been at this for so many months or so many years, and it seems like I've got nothing to show for this. And maybe your husband or your wife might be asking you, well, what now? Are you going to persist? Are you keep at this? Or are you going to do something else and just give up? And people around you might start asking you questions about the direction that you're heading in, because there's nothing to show. And I know this can be hard, but remember that even though you know, change might seem really slow, if you're taking action and if you're resilient and if you don't give up and if you keep coming back to it, you are changing from within. And that's the most important change that can happen to you, right? From within. Because the truth is that you need to have patience, Action Tribe. And try visiting someone you haven't met for years, because they'll tell you just how much you have changed. And this again is a quote from Lama's book. Because just like Nelson Mandela once said, there is nothing like returning to a place that remains unchanged to find the ways in which you yourself have altered. So change is happening. Just be patient. So with that, we have reached the last round for today, which is the wisdom round. Four quick questions so that our listeners can get a dose of wisdom to act on So Lama, what is the best piece of advice that you've received in your life?
I think it was that what my therapist said to me about self-love and contemplating that, because I've really found that has been the key to being a happier human being and to actually being able, be able to love and others and to find a wellspring of well-being and inspiration, enthusiasm, and all of that within my own heart, within my own body. And, you know, so I think for me, that's been the most profound.
Got it. And if you could turn back time and go spend 1 hour with someone who is living or even dead, who would it be?
Well, I'd have to say that would be my teacher, Kala Rinpoche. And I do feel connected to him on the inner subtle plane, but it would also be wonderful to see him in person and have an hour to share and talk.
Got it. And so what is that one thing you do in the morning or maybe in the evening before you go to sleep that has improved the quality of your life?
It's really to connect with my gurus and awaken presence and just to open into what is with no judgment and to be with that and to bring loving kindness to it. And so connecting with what is and also recognizing that in what is also all these awakened beings who are, or we could say, you know, God, who's always depending on our, you know, religious orientation, but that's ever present, like God or the awakened beings, however we're going to language that, they are ever present. Mm-hmm. And they're always with us. So we open to what is, but it's not just a dry, vast, dead, boring, horrible what is. You know, as well as we see all the ups and downs and everything, but we can also in that connect with the awakened or divine presence. So doing that has really benefited me a lot.
Wonderful. And if you could recommend one book for our listeners, what would that book be?
Well, from the Tibetan tradition, I would recommend a book called Rainbow Painting by Tulku Urgyen Rinpoche. So Rainbow Painting, quite a wonderful book. Yes.
Got it. So we'll have that in the show notes. Action Tribe, would you like to receive one book for free, an audiobook? Because audible.com, as you might know, is offering Action Tribe one free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial so that you can try out this new way of consuming books. Because the truth is that listening is the new form of reading. And the fact that you're listening to this episode proves my point. So if you'd like to start listening to books and trying out these Audible books, which are so amazing, go to my7chakras.com/freebook. That's my7chakras.com/freebook and choose your favorite book to start listening. So Lama, thank you so much for spending your time on our show and sharing all of this wisdom and actually explaining to us how this amazing visual and step-by-step meditation works so that we can transform our life.
And, you're so welcome. A pleasure to be with you.
And before you go, tell us one thing that you're grateful for and how we can find you online.
Oh, okay. So I'm just grateful that we have this amazing life and that we have each other, that we have friends, that you and I were able to talk and share this morning and with your listeners as well. So I'm grateful for all of that. And also to let your listeners know, my book, this Love on Every Breath, is also available on audio at Amazon. And my website is lamapalden.org, LamaPalden.org. So they can connect with me there. And there's some freebies and there'll be a link to listen to this. And so you can find out more about me and connect there. And it's a delight speaking with you this morning and being with your listeners.
Awesome. So we'll have all these links up in the show notes and so that people can, you know, take the next steps and get this book because it's an amazing book and really, really informative. If you've listened so far, Action Tribe, it means that you're really enjoying today's episode. If you feel different, if you feel optimistic, then consider supporting our podcast. because we really, really depend on you to create more episodes and produce this amazing stuff on our show. The link you need is my7chakras.com/support. my7chakras.com/support. It's completely safe and secure. If you're on Instagram, then take a screenshot of this episode or take a photo of you and tag me so that I can share your story with our community. My handle is @my7chakras. That's @my7chakras. And finally, if you have a question, comment, observation, experience that you'd like to relate or share, my email is aj@my7chakras.com. That's aj@my7chakras.com. So Lama, thank you so much for coming on our show, talking to us about your story, the difficult and the amazing moments of your life, explaining to us about Buddhism and the journey that you went through, and taking us one step closer to a human revolution so that each of us can realize that Buddhahood is within our grasp and is there for all of us.
Thank you so much. A pleasure.
Thank you for listening to My Seven Chakras at my7chakras.com. That is my7chakras.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.